Well, we looked into it and we studied it, and this week is not going to review itself, people. So here we are with the KUOW Week in Review. My name is Luke Burbank. I'm in for Bill Radke, and we have a lot to talk about this week, including the fact that pot is now legal.
I'm actually going to be moving out to Missouri in like a month, and I was just like, I want to get some legal weed before I'm out there where there's no legal weed at all.
Also, turns out Brazil is maybe not the soccer powerhouse we were led to believe it was.
For Brazil, for the Brazilian people, you know, it's very embarrassing, you know.
And if you donated some human skulls to your local Goodwill, the authorities want to talk to you, but you are not in trouble.
The person who donated them to give us a call without penalty, and certainly I don't intend to lecture or in any way make him or her feel badly. I just, because I know it was done in complete innocence.
Happens all the time, people. It is going to be a scorcher this weekend. Temperatures are going to approach 90 degrees, and we have assembled pretty much the leading hot weather expert panel you can get on a public radio show here on this Friday. Knut Berger writes the Mossback column over at Crosscut Magazine. Knut, how do you like to enjoy the rare, scorching hot Seattle weekend?
I'm glad I live someplace where there's a pool.
We also have Joni Balter here. She hosts Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, and she is a contributor at Bloomberg View. What is your plan for the weekend?
I'm going to just sit out in the sun and realize that it won't be like this forever.
You would try to really just kinda enjoy the good
just
times.
Just kind of grab it, because this is the hottest. This is the hottest weekend of the year.
It's interesting in Seattle because we complain about how it doesn't get warm enough, and then I'd give it about probably 30 minutes tomorrow
exactly.
before people start complaining about how it's too hot.
There are already headlines about drought and fire danger.
Eli Sanders is associate editor over at The Stranger. Are you going to be out biking around like you do in this hot weather?
I'm going to take a ferry to the Olympic Peninsula and go hiking. So hopefully cool on the ferry, and I'm not sure hiking was the best idea.
Well, clear of the goats, please.
I'm recently transplanted out there to the Olympic Peninsula, and what they tell me, I don't know if it's true or not, is that it's always 10 degrees colder in the summer and 10 degrees warmer in the winter.
Perfect.
So it should be the perfect temperature out there. If you would like to join our conversation, weather-related or human skull-related or whatever you have to offer, we have all kinds of ways for that to happen. You can tweet at us, at KUOW. You can email us, weekinreview@KUOW, and you can even call us, and we have a pretty awesome phone number. It's 206-685-BLAM.
I'm still going to use my guy, you know what I mean? But that's not to say that during some situations, because say my guy isn't a baker, and there's going to be specific things that you can get in these recreational stores that you're not going to be able to access through your guy.
That is Mark Ruprecht. He was talking to Patricia Murphy. He was over at Cannabis City. This is a huge week for legal nug enthusiasts. We also have to start casually dropping terms like nug enthusiast, because recreational marijuana is now legal in the state after lots of wrangling and back and forth and fixing the standards for how the nugs were going to look and, I guess, taste. How do you feel, Joni Balter, this has gone? Has it been a successful week so far, or what?
Well, so I went on down to Cannabis City myself for the high noon opening with the folks down there, the security guards. I was going to wear one of those today, those green fright wigs, they call them, that the security guards were wearing at Cannabis City. And it was quite a scene down there. It was very, you know, party atmosphere, music, all the good stuff. But it was kind of, it was in its own way, it was kind of low-key. I kept thinking they could be giving away toaster ovens in there, because it was just people lined up, all this excitement, the music. They had a little bit of a delayed opening. We had the city attorney.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about this, this is somewhat not against type for him, but against type for a city attorney, kind of law and order.
And by the way, coming up a little later on in the show, we are going to give you the Seattle Police Department's reaction to the city attorney getting his nug on. And it was not a positive one.
Oh,
let's put it that way.
Oh, so they got rid of the humor writers down at SPD. Is that
it's
right?
It's the other wing of the Seattle
That's
Police
right.
Department.
No, the no Dorito.
That's
the
right. The anti-Dorito party within the department. But anyway, more on that in a moment. So people had green wigs on. The security did. Everybody else was, it was sort of a big party, I guess.
Big party. Big party in the blazing sun. They didn't open exactly at the right second, but it was just very festive. And, you know, pot opened here more with a whimper than with a bang because there just wasn't enough of it. And a lot of folks had predicted that because they were, you know, the Liquor Control Board was just overwhelmed with the number of applications. And so it took them a very, very long time to get all the applications that they've approved. And so the pot takes a minute to grow, you know.
Mm-hmm. I learned that in college. Eli, you guys were writing over at The Stranger. I know you sent Dominic Holden down to buy some of the legal marijuana. And I was struck by how detailed the packaging is, which is something Dominic pointed out.
Yeah, it's amazing. The label with the information about what's in the weed, where it came from. I mean, it's like the dream of every person who shops at a farmer's market and wants their locally sourced, pedigree included tomato with a long resume. It's that.
It seems to be for the folks that you'll see at the bar that has 150 beers on tap, and they've tried 137 of them, where they're, I call those people completists. When they want to know about something, they want to really have a full understanding. I'm the kind of guy who goes in, I just like, give me a Rainier or whatever. But those sorts of folks, I think, can maybe get into the almost micro-brewing component of this.
And maybe we'll say, okay, it's worth the higher price. Because right now, due to the shortage in supply that Joni was talking about, the price is going to be higher at the state stores than on the black market, which is the exact opposite of what everyone was going for here with legalization.
Yeah, but don't worry about that. As soon as the pot starts, you know, coming online, this is all going to settle out in my book.
Well, that's what I was going to skip. I know you wouldn't pay any money for a nug because I learned reading in Crosscut that you, despite every outward appearance
of being a stoner,
are not much of a fan of the marijuana for yourself anyway. So you probably wouldn't go out and buy this stuff. But do you think this financial model will work when you can go to Westlake Square and buy it for pennies on the dollar?
Well, that's a great question. The Stranger also had interviews with what Siena Madrid did, interviews with pot dealers. And, it's the free market. I mean, I love the way the market's adjusting. Like, these guys are figuring out, well, what, you know, I'm an illegal dealer, but what's my, how can I get a leg up on the market? You know, so one guy says, well, I'm making baked goods like Rice Krispie bars, not pot bars, but I'm selling pot, but I'm also going to sell the munchie stuff to go along. So you can
see, it's like the coffee stand next to Boeing.
Yeah.
You're sort of
you're
the remora clinging to the larger ocean going animal.
Well, and they're making other adjustments as well in terms of all the publicity about legalized marijuana has boosted a lot of dealers' business because people, pot is more top of mind. Hazy mind, but still top of mind. And people go to what's easy, you know, where it's easiest to buy, and that's often, you know, your ongoing connection. So it's a complicated market. It's going to be complicated for a while, and it's going to be a while before Costco jumps in, you know.
I can see it now. You buy your Kirkland brand jeans, and there's just a joint in the back pocket, but you have to buy like 20 pair.
You have to. Yeah.
Joni, you look like you...
Well, I'm just saying here, the market's supposed to set the price. The market is rolling out like scary slowly because of the limitations that we
have. And also, I will say, I chatted with as of a week ago, there were, I think, two marijuana growers in the state who'd actually jumped through the proper hoops. And one of them was here in Seattle, if memory serves. I think they're called Sea Green, maybe. And I talked to one of the guys who runs that organization, and he just he and his group were just always going in on the day that the state said you can bring in your plants and, you know, you can call us back on this day to find out the results. But a lot of the people producing this stuff, shocker, didn't get it together to actually get their marijuana crop like licensed with the state, right?
Right. And so that's what's going on here. So I talked to a grower over in the Okanagan area, Canasol, and they had some troubles getting their permit and all of this. But the phone is ringing off the hook from these retailers that want, please give us some pot, because what's going to happen, and this is the bumpy part. So these retailers who are opening, there's only like a handful that have opened, but 25 or maybe a little more by now are licensed. But these retailers are, you know, going to have a situation where they can have pot for sale one day, but the next day they're out. And so that is tough on them. And so that's where some of the complaints that you're going to hear are coming from.
You've got to get consistency in the supply chain.
Yeah.
That's so you the management.
How do you keep a staff on if you can only sell pot on Tuesdays and Saturdays?
But I still wonder about the business model, because, for instance, when we privatized liquor sales in this state, the price obviously went up. But that was a convenience. I can go to QFC and buy my bottle of medicine, you know, like midnight now if I want to. It's either that or feel my feelings. So make a beeline for the liquor cabinet. Anyway, but the difference between alcohol and marijuana is, if I didn't want to go pay that price, the price that Costco or these other retailers are charging, I don't really have an alternative. With marijuana, there's a vibrant and now longstanding alternative, which is the cheaper stuff. Can the price ever get low enough, you think, through this official system for it to be competitive?
Well, that's what they expect. They expect to have this. So at the beginning, it's expensive, it's limited, and your dealers. I saw the dealer who was interviewed who said he delivers, so that would deal with your midnight problem.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, they never expected, and they're off by their projections. But they never expected the legal stuff to be a huge percentage of the market right away, only 25% in the first year. I think that's the right number, something like that. But the gist of it is that over time, people are going to supposedly want the legal stuff. You know why? Because it's inspected. And you know why it's inspected? Because there's a lot of funky stuff in mm-hmm. pot. So they check for mites, mold, what else do they do? Pesticides, all that kind of stuff. So there's supposedly a value in getting something that's been inspected. It's just that it's so hard to get right now, but that should settle out.
Eli, what do you think about the stigma? And by that I mean, you know, we were talking about how marijuana sales are – the rising tide seems to be lifting all boats,
mm-hmm.
both the state-run stores and also the people that are just, I guess, standing out on the corner with some weed. That seems to speak to a – I don't know, a relaxing of people's thoughts about this. Do you think that's really happening, or is it just that the people who – we're already fine with marijuana, continue to be fine with it. Do you think people's minds will actually change now that it has the imprimatur of the state of Washington?
I think so. I think when something's legal, people are more open to it. You know, the people out there who would not do something, who are so goody-two-shoes that they will not do something, even with all the cultural discussion about pot because it's illegal, now have lost that barrier. So however large a population that is, I think it's more inviting to them. On the subject of financial barriers, whether it's worth paying more for legal pot. Dominic Holden has an interesting post on Slog, why it's worth it to pay more for legal pot. And the sort of summary of it is legalization provides something prohibition never could, explicit certainty about what I purchased, what it contains, what it doesn't contain, where it came from, where the money goes, and the promise that every time I purchase this product, it'll be essentially the same. That's basically what Joni was saying. And also, I assume there's a return policy, which is something you don't get with a dealer, right? You get a receipt, you get a product. There must be some way to take it back if you don't like it, I would think. Or maybe some store will come up with that as a competitive advantage.
Yeah, good luck chasing down that guy you met at a Folklife drum circle.
However, there's this flip side argument about the loss of a cultural phenomenon with that guy you met at the Folklife drum circle. The culture in which it's illegal, and so you are engaged in an illicit transaction with basically a stranger who comes to your house, or you go to his house, or you go to some private space with him or her, and you sit down and you have a conversation and you share a bowl. There's this whole, you know, rhythm of that transaction, and you talk about strange things that are on his mind,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you pay for your weed after sampling it, probably, and then he goes. But it takes an hour or a half an hour or 20 minutes. And there's something interesting about that interaction that you don't get from a cash register.
It's like that three cups of tea idea.
Yeah.
You know, well, you sit with the person who brought the stuff. You enjoy it together. You have, again, I've been involved in some of these conversations. Sort of have a conversation you would never otherwise have, but it's all part of the dance, I guess.
But that was part of the appeal of the original Starbucks, which was a place where these aficionados could come in and focus on their drug of choice, which was caffeine.
Mm-hmm. You can keep talking. I do appreciate how receptive you are, though, to the audio cues,
yeah,
Canute.
Exactly.
This is Week in Review. I'm Luke Burbank in for Bill Radke. I've got Canute Berger here, also Eli Sanders and Joni Balter. When we come back, the city attorney of Seattle, Pete Holmes, was one of the first in line at Cannabis City, and That decision and the subsequent photo op is not going over great with some elements in the Seattle Police Department. We'll get into that coming up in a moment. All right, welcome back to Week in Review here on KUOW. I'm Luke Burbank in for Bill. We've got this email from Rico. By the way, if you would like to enjoy the public adulation that Rico will get after this email reading on a public radio station, you can email us at kuow.org. It's Week in Review, excuse me, W-I-R at kuow.org. Rico says, the stuff at Cannabis City was a joke. Sure, it was tested, but the THC levels were very low. Apparently, Rico also says the testing facility said that, quote, some samples have been disappointingly unaromatic, which I would count. And again, I'm not somebody who partakes a lot, but I would consider a lack of aroma a real upside to this whole situation. We have Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, and Knute Berger here. This is a kind of an interesting side development on this whole legalization of recreational marijuana story. And that is that Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes was sort of first in line to buy marijuana on Tuesday. And this, of course, made the news. And then shortly afterwards, this is Cairo 7 TV reporting, shortly afterwards, a drawing depicting a stoned city attorney smoking a joint at his desk was posted at the West Precinct in an area where only officers can go. Let me tell you what the caption was. This is not going to win any New Yorker caption entering contest. The caption was, dude, I totally rolled this with an assault on an officer report. Hey, hey, whoa. And then when asked about, oh, by the way, he's also this character who looks a lot like Holmes, appears to have a pack of Cheetos and a police report on his desk. His eyes are bloodshot. When asked about this, Seattle police spokesman Sean Whitcomb said, we have very good artists on this department.
Well, I'll just say that, you know, Pete Holmes was one of the enthusiasts for Initiative 502. And he sort of loves the getting together of it all, you know, being part of the city party about this. And you will remember, maybe you won't, back in December, the one-year anniversary of legalization, there was a pot party at Seattle Center. And he was sort of critical of it because it was in view of kids, or maybe in view of kids if the fence wasn't high enough, this whole bit. And so he had told me that he wasn't going to go to that. And then one of his press And then he sort of changed his mind. He wanted to go, and one of his press people said, no, he's not going to that. So he wasn't able to go to that. So I think his sort of desire to be part of it built up until Tuesday he went to Cannabis City and could not contain himself any further.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, part of the whole issue with cultural change, it's interesting that cartoon caption is alluding to police brutality, use of force. The department is supposedly undergoing this cultural shift, and you know, you can clearly see there's some resentment about it. It gives you an idea of, I mean, give him credit for having a sense of humor. The best stuff always appears on the company bulletin board, right?
I thought it was interesting that the police spokesman, Sean Whitcomb, didn't give some sort of obligatory, well, the person who drew that is being reprimanded. I mean, he just said, like, it was a pretty sweet cartoon, basically.
They're trying to have more of a sense of humor, and Sean Whitcomb is one of the better ones at that. It's interesting that they have such good artists. I don't know what that says about how much time they might be practicing sitting in their cars on break drawing. The artistry and policing is not something I put together normally.
But, you know, that you're talking about trying to have a sense of humor about things, and that's really this this real, I guess you could say, schism in the department, right? Or the people that thought it was funny that they handed out Doritos at Hempfest, and that Pete Holmes is buying marijuana. And then the part of the SPD that feel like this is unbecoming.
Well, that was the problem, actually. And KUOW broke that story about that. One of the problems was that some folks in SPD communications think that there is humor. There should be humor in Twitter. There should be humor in Hempfest. There should be humor in Doritos. And some other folks didn't find it that funny, felt it was sort of condoning it. And they had this whole to-do in that department this year about that. And so that's – and Sean, by the way, Sean Whitcomb was on the let's be funny side.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if Pete Holmes had lined up to buy a new microbrew, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So it seems to be a bit of a disconnect because it's now legal. I think most people would agree that the effects of marijuana on somebody can't be any more deleterious than the effects of an alcohol drink. And yet we, some of us anyway, kind of our head turns a little bit when we hear that the city attorney was buying weed.
Having just like a big, isn't this a great day?
Yeah, he bought one, he said, for posterity, and he bought one for personal use.
Right, which led to the cartoon that said he's sitting at his desk going over reports with all of this.
The city attorney is supposed to enforce the law, which the police are as well, by the way. And when the law changes, you don't have to obey the old law for one more minute. I mean, I don't see any problem with him operating under the new law. And his interest, as I understand it, in marijuana legalization is not just its relative bad effects compared to alcohol, although you can make that argument, and it's a strong argument, but also the social justice aspect. I've heard him talk about that a lot, and the incarceration rates that are unfair across different communities for pot busts and the misuse of resources, taxpayer resources, and on and on and on. And so for him to be celebrating an end to an era that was really destructive in a lot of ways, what's the problem with that?
This is the Week in Review on KUOW. That was Eli Sanders from The Stranger you just heard from. We've also got Joni Balter here from Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, and Knut, sometimes known as Skip Berger, from the Mossback column over at Crosscut, and also Seattle Magazine. My name is Luke Burbank, in for Bill Radke. Coming up in a moment, there is no joy in Mudville, a.k.a. Brazil, as their beloved team goes down and goes down hard. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Everyone was like, didn't know what to do, and we could notice that in the players, and the defense was all the players were like just staring at each other and what's going on. And then it just kept on going, and we're like, please, Germany, have mercy on us.
A distraught Brazilian fan. We now know the World Cup final will feature Germany versus Argentina, or as I'm calling it, Germany versus a bunch of dudes who may have German grandparents. Now, listen, this was the most, at least it was described as the most tweeted event in world history. And many of those tweets were involving the same kind of lazy humor that I just employed, kind of vaguely Nazi-related jokes. And if you looked at Twitter the day that this match happened, it was full. I mean, somebody wrote that the German players just said they were following the instructions of their coach. I mean, it was flying all over the place online. And then there was the whole backlash. First question out of the gate, do we have to retire that sort of those kinds of jokes, or are we still allowed to have some fun with the fact that Germany did try to take the entire globe down like 50 years ago?
Well, I still apply wars to who I'm going to root for in sport. You know, there's a World War II model. I also have a Civil War model.
Oh, really?
You know, like when it comes to football teams, you know, never root for any team that was from a Confederate state, you know, that kind of thing. So there's certain rules one goes by. And I think World War II is
it's recent enough.
World events. Enough. That's what happened to the Dallas Cowboys. Absolutely. After Kennedy was killed. People referred very bad phrases toward that team.
I've developed a really, I would say, sort of not great habit of going to the photographs of the losing team's fans after.
I saw that.
Oh, my goodness gracious. It is. I mean, those are some interesting visuals to look, in this case, the Brazilian fans. But whenever, and because it's like that face paint looks great when you're putting it on before the match, but
it's like very sad clown.
Well, when you put it on, you're smiling.
Yeah.
And it just goes to pieces when that's not the expression at the end.
I really feel sorry for Brazil because the World Cup already has been so controversial there in terms of the spending. The organization that sponsors the World Cup is walking away with something like $2 billion in profit out of a third world country that's having trouble with basic infrastructure. People, the volunteers for the World Cup that come from all over the world, the young people, they were told not to wear their uniforms outside the venues.
Yeah, FIFA has come out looking pretty bad in this particular World Cup.
And the one thing they could count on was their team would win. And it didn't. So the aftermath of this World Cup, I think, in Brazil is going to be something to watch.
We've been talking about Seattle getting more invested in soccer and whether Seattle is becoming more European. We were talking about this last week, and here's a potential downside of that, that our civic psyche swings like Brazil's on a win or a loss.
I was looking at, I'm trying to remember the publication, might have been the New York Times. They had this article about a city in Brazil that's in the Amazon where it floods every year and the kids play soccer on the roof of a restaurant. And they're living in these, you know, really tough conditions. And in every little small sort of shanty hut is a Brazilian soccer jersey. And you realize that the hopes and dreams of this nation and in these favelas is riding with these guys. And you start to really want to root for whatever country is the most socioeconomically disadvantaged.
Well, also think about what's happening with the Olympics as well. That's, you know, sometimes there's too much attached to hosting, that your whole nationhood's identity is attached to it. So you're finding a lot of countries don't even want to host the Olympics anymore.
You really get the feeling that the nation of Brazil couldn't afford this, but they just thought, wouldn't it be cool if we hosted this thing and if our team won? And unlike, you know, some other country that doesn't have a storied soccer program, it actually was a real possibility for Brazil this year. But when they lost, again, it was more than just national pride. I mean, they just had a bridge collapse or an overpass collapse that was part of one of these many projects in Brazil that did not get finished in time for the World Cup, that was started as part of the overall World Cup redesign of the country.
We should say they were missing their star forward, Neymar, who was out because of a back injury.
The first time one of these soccer players has actually been hurt, by the way.
Really?
I mean, really hurt as opposed to faking it. So they go down like they were just attacked by a mob of thugs. And then they get up and they seem to be weirdly okay. Not that I wanted Neymar to be hurt, but some part of me was relieved that he was actually injured, because the sort of theatrics of these guys, you know, flopping is like so over the top. So you're right, Eli, they didn't have Neymar.
They didn't have Neymar. They also didn't have their captain, who was out because he got, I think, two yellow cards in too quick a succession. So they were down two players. On Neymar, I also found it a little concerning that, you know, he goes down, and maybe this is because people fake it so often, but they bring out basically a basket. They kind of roll him into it, jostle him off the field, bouncing the basket, and then it turns out he's got a back injury. Like, maybe they could take a little better care of the guys as they're dragging him off the field.
Well, in one of the recent matches, two guys unintentionally headbutted each other going for a header, and the one guy looked like he was in the movie Rocky IV.
Yeah.
I mean, stumbled to the turf and then continued playing.
They sent him right back on.
Which, I mean, I think anybody in America who's been following the football concussion conversations was probably a little bit aghast.
Absolutely, because you can't, you know, when you're seeing all those stars, to go back out there is just wild. You know, Brazil even had Nate Silver on its side going into this. And he had, I have never seen a, did anybody see the Nate Silver tweet?
No, we finally found Nate Silver's statistical weakness.
He said, "It's time to eat crow. That prediction stunk." Have you ever read any such thing from Nate Silver? Because he, even with those key people not playing, he thought Brazil was going to win.
It's funny how people, Americans, often criticize soccer for being a sissy sport, but we're the ones that coddle athletes with you know, extra padding and huge insurance coverage, and you know, there's so much attention paid. Now you can't even slide into the catcher at home
right.
At home in baseball. It's like, and when you travel in the rest of the world, there's just much less litigation and consciousness about that. You can climb an old castle that's falling apart and stand like right on the edge. And in America, you know, there'd have to be, you know, barriers and handicapped ramps. And I mean, and it's, there's something about soccer that's just, you know, a little more raw.
Is it a given that we're all rooting for Argentina in the final? I mean, I don't want to sound anti-Germanic, but if you're talking about the storied soccer programs and you're talking about Lionel Messi and the sort of beautiful game, which I know is more Brazil's thing, versus the efficient sort of nature of the German team, I think probably not. And everywhere in the world outside of Germany is probably rooting for Argentina in this, right?
There's something much more exciting about the South American style of play in soccer, and so that part of me wants to root for Argentina, but I also am drawn to the kind of Swiss watch precision of the German play. It actually is very beautiful in its own way, so it's a hard one for me.
Well, it'll be fun to watch. This is The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Luke Burbank in for Bill Radke. Coming up in a moment, Harborview is making plans to try some experiments on you if you're brought in and you're unconscious. And if you don't want it to happen, you've got to go down there like today and opt out. We'll explain coming up.
Reasonable people would say, if you have nothing, try this new thing because I'd rather not die or I'd rather not face this severe brain damage. So I do think it's ethical.
That is Arthur Kaplan. He's the head of bioethics over at NYU. And he's talking about Harborview's decision. And Harborview is not the only hospital that's doing this. There are a number of hospitals around the country that want to and are planning on administering a new drug to people who are brought in with a traumatic brain injury to try to sort of arrest the damage. I didn't realize this before reading the article on this, but for certain sorts of situations, I guess they don't have to get your consent for this.
Well, it's a rough moment to be getting consent. You come in unconscious, and you know, I've heard some of the ethicists talking on KOW and Reddit and some other places. The idea is, well, can't you hurry up and call a family member? Well, even if you came in an ambulance, the family member is probably not present in the moments that they think are the key moments to do this. And so they do have to make the decision. I mean, it sounds like it works. You wish everybody could be contacted. And that's really what Harborview is wrestling with here. What do you do when you're bypassing informed consent? Can you do this community outreach program that they're engaging in right now? And is it sufficient to tell people that if you come in, they're going to try this drug, it may stem some of the bleeding, which leads to all these horrible outcomes. You will be, you know, an unwilling guinea pig, but your other choice isn't so hot either.
Well, they sign you up in the ambulance while you're unconscious. Okay, so you're actually signed into the drug trial when you're on your way to the hospital.
Wait, I'm not trying to be glib, but do they take your hand and Weekend at Bernie's it or what?
Yeah, they do it all. They all do all the paperwork for you.
Okay,
and not everybody gets this drug. Some people are getting saline solution. In other words, it is an experiment.
Hmm. And so there's essentially a placebo as well?
Yeah. As I understand it.
There's a separate procedure where they – and this is – I think the hospital is in Pittsburgh where what they're trying to do is pump cold saline through a person's system, essentially replacing a lot of their blood and hopefully bringing into arrest what the damage is, which is a totally separate thing. But when you mention the saline – I hadn't been thinking of that.
Well, it's interesting. And so the idea is that if you can essentially, by informing the community broadly enough, and this is legal, and giving people a chance to opt out, which can consist of, you know, contacting the hospital, telling them you don't want that procedure ever done on you, and getting a bracelet, or I don't know who wants to wear a bracelet. It seems kind of, but
opt out.
They're reaching out to communities where traumatic head injuries are more common, the homeless and bike riders among them.
Well, when I heard Marcy Silman interviewing this person that you played at the top of the hour, I actually, when she was questioning him, I thought that he was going to say no, it's not ethical, but in sort of each version of the same, of a similar question, the answer was, well, under the circumstances, it's probably ethical because it could be so helpful. I was surprised by the answer. I was.
The thing, though, that's worth mentioning, and it was in the Seattle Times piece on this, apparently there was a different procedure that was similarly described that Harborview was conducting that when it was studied out was killing a lot of people. And I don't know if those people had died at Harborview or just elsewhere in the study, but of course, we assume anything is better than nothing. But then if it hasn't been tested yet, right, we don't actually know what it is.
And how would you test this is the other thing.
Well, that's the problem, right? You literally can't test this on humans unless the humans are in a very, very sort of precarious predicament. I can't see very many people going in and opting out of this because, number one, that involves an incredible amount of forethought and planning on having a traumatic brain injury, which I think we all sort of move through the world hoping that doesn't happen to us, and somehow going in and planning for it probably feels a little macabre.
And even reaching out to communities at risk of traumatic brain injury, those communities don't see themselves that way for the most part. So they're not, I don't know that they're going to be that responsive to it.
Yeah. I think that with this one, there hasn't been a ton of controversy because, Joni, of what you were mentioning, which is the feeling that when you find yourself in that particular situation, you'll take any help you can get.
Well, think of Natasha Richardson, who had a skiing accident, mm-hmm. and apparently they didn't. I wasn't there, don't know, but apparently they didn't use this. And now, mm-hmm. in hindsight, that there might be something that helps her. Oh, my gosh, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There's another story out of Europe. The Formula One driver, Michael Schumacher, who was injured, not unlike Natasha Richardson, he was injured skiing and was actually treated with the most modern medicine, and they took it very seriously. And he was released from the hospital recently after months and months and months of being in and out of various comas and such. So that those couple of hours right after the injury are so pivotal for your possible long-term survival. This is the Week in Review. My name is Luke Burbank, in for Bill Radke today. We have Eli Sanders here from The Stranger and Joni Balter here from Civic Cocktail. And, of course, Knute Berger from Crosscut and also from Seattle Magazine. If you would like to be part of the conversation, you can always email us. It's wir@kuow.org. You can tweet at us. If you're one of those young people who uses the Twitter, it's @KUOW. And you could even give us a call if you're one of those old people who uses the phone, 206-685-BLAM. Those are the phone numbers. We'll be back with more in just a minute.
Oh, my God.
This is? These are octocopters.
Yeah.
These are effectively drones, but there's no reason that they can't be used as delivery vehicles.
Or used as terrifying sky demons over the skies of Seattle. That is Jeff Bezos on 60 Minutes. Amazon is now requesting the right to test some drones in a sort of new capacity. Of course, the controversial idea of drones. And Eli, you know a little bit more about this. What exactly do they want to do?
Well, first to say that 60-minute interview is old history now in terms of the drones that Bezos has. He was talking about the drones they showed off, I think, earlier this year that might deliver Amazon products. They have now, in some secret testing lab in Seattle, apparently gone through 8 generations of development of new drones since then. And they can now carry 5-pound loads at over 50 miles an hour. Great news. So with this new 8th generation drone ability, Bezos would like to deliver Amazon goods all over the city and is requesting permission from the FAA to use Seattle as essentially a testing ground for something that the FAA currently doesn't allow, which is commercial use of drones. You can't do that right now in the United States, if I'm understanding the federal rules correctly.
Maybe I just read a lot of sci-fi as a kid, or really, you know, thought the Jetsons was a documentary, but I think this would be the coolest thing. And I always feel like I'm the only person, when we start having these conversations, who thinks this is a great idea. There's a lot of suspicion about this.
Well, you know, something that is moving at 50 miles an hour with spinning blades that are capable of lifting a 5-pound object, that's great when you see it, you know, moving through the air and have a Jetsons fantasy fulfillment, and also when you get your product delivered to you. But say it falls on your head, or say the blades knock into you. That's not a good outcome.
Well, this is the Domino's pizza delivery motto: if you need your product within 30 minutes mm-hmm. or less, mm-hmm. and I know you do.
Always.
Yeah. So, but there were problems with the 30-minute delivery, if anybody wants to remember that. I mean, I just, I guess I'm not super excited about people shooting packages out of the sky or these things buzzing around where you can see them 50 miles an hour. But, you know, I love the Jetsons, too, so let's see what happens. I don't think that they're going to get the approval.
The idea of a billionaire with a secret lab and his private robot drone swarm, you know, it just conjures up. I love the way.
Not to mention that the building where they sort of first made their name in Seattle perched up there at the end of Beacon Hill. I mean, that looks like an evil lair.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's be honest.
It looks like kind of Dr. Frankenstein's
The only person
tower.
Who wins in that whole evil genius thing is the cat. They always get a really good petting. Like, to be an evil genius's cat would be a little slice of heaven.
But imagining, you know, millions of these things flying around delivering packages to people who've paid, you know, Air Prime, I think is the service they call it, you know. And, you know, is I mean, it's to imagine... If you don't like jet skis, can you imagine what it's going to be like to have all these drones swarming through the city and the noise and the...
The next letter will say they're going to be quiet. And the letter right. that follows be, oh, the one we all have yeah. in our possession will say how quiet they're going to be. But what about the visual blight, folks?
I think he's doing it just because he wants to keep Amazon on that sort of people talking about it mm-hmm. in a sort of, you know, they're on the cutting edge of the future.
Right. Like, because they submitted that patent for the... cell phone jet pack that would catch your phone if it fell. Did you guys ever see this? This was years ago. Amazon submitted a patent application for a bunch of little, like, I guess it would be four little compressed air packets that would go on a phone case. So if your phone fell, they would fire off and keep your phone from breaking. Very difficult to achieve, but kind of what you're talking about, Knut. They want to, if they have a good idea, they might as well try to patent it, try to test it, try to put it out there, if only to seem very futuristic.
Right. You wonder if there's a guy over there like Q in the James Bond films, you know, trying this stuff out. It sounds like it.
It sounds like there is. I just was getting flashbacks to 2 weeks ago or so when we were here talking about the drone that was spotted in front of the woman's high-rise apartment in downtown Seattle, and she called the police and said, there's a drone peeping in my window. And this was a legal use of a drone. This was a surveying company working for a developer that was like checking out the view from a proposed building. But imagine, you know, a fleet of Amazon delivery drones running past your window and the misuse that someone could put them to potentially, or just the fear of them looking in your window.
I'm the kind of person who loves the idea of this futuristic technology and these little things whizzing around. It excites me. And yet I also feel like it's part of maybe a not great development in our culture, which is this need for instant gratification. I mean, you can already get stuff delivered. Like if you order a mattress before 2 o'clock, they can have it at your house that night. Right. That's a real thing. It's like, how much faster do we really need it to be?
And if you need it, you've heard of those things called stores where you drive up.
I'm not familiar.
And if you need the item that bad, you...
What would they even build that out of, like bricks or something or mortar?
Park and you get your item.
Well, on the one hand, you don't want to be one of those people who's like, well, you know, we shouldn't have trains because
right. Well, see, that's why
nicer.
I feel bad making that argument.
But then the flip side of it is, think of all those newsreels you've seen over the year where the inventor had, you know, the hat tipper thing on his head or the wings that he could fly. I mean, people come up with dumb crackpot stuff all the time that you wouldn't want.
It does feel like yet another thing that we've come up with that sounds really cool and is more instant gratification-y and replaces yet more human jobs. So that you sit at your computer and you order your thing from Amazon and a robot puts it on a conveyor belt which takes it to a drone which flies it to your doorstep and drops it there.
Some years ago, they opened a time capsule from 1962 where city employees had made predictions about the future. And one of the predictions was, well, we'll only be working like 20 hours a week because robots will be doing the rest of the work. And so we'll have all this leisure time. And it was seen in the 1960s as not it's going to put us out of a job, but I'm going to be able to spend my time at Hood Canal.
Eli, to your point, every job that's lost in the delivery industry will be replaced by the coming and helping people who've been hit by a drone industry. So it'll just net out.
That is why.
Right. Harborview is going to be really busy.
If we do have sort of this breakout of drones, we do not want our city attorney down shopping for, you know, because we're going to need his.
We need his eye on the ball as much as possible. All right. We're at an important part of the show here, Knut. And Eli and Joni, are you guys ready for the lightning round?
Oh, well.
The thunder round.
Well, see, this is a controversial part of the show because I said to producer Jason Pagano, we need a lightning sound. And he said, lightning is just light. The thunder is what makes the sound.
That is controversial.
That was very public radio.
Yeah, very.
Very public radio of him.
So.
Welcome to the thunder round, or maybe as we call it, the thunder dome. We're going to try to get through as many of these stories as we can. In the last, I don't know what we have here, about 6 or 7 minutes of the show.
You know, this is when we normally call a Luke.
Yes, yeah. I know. That is why we still decided to try to make this part of the show overly trivial, to keep consistent with the typical week in and week out adventures. All right. A guy in Ohio is currently at $46,000 on Kickstarter for a potato salad that he wants to make. He put up a photo of potato salad. He said, I'm going to make a potato salad. I'm not sure which kind. And his goal was to raise $10. And the internet got a hold of it. And at one point, it was up in the $70,000 to $80,000 range. I guess Kickstarter is somewhat dynamic. So right now, it's at about $46,000. But the thought that I had when I saw this immediately was not, well, good for you, internet entrepreneur. My thought was, you really better give that money to charity, dude.
Right, because it didn't look like very spectacular potato salad. Did you see it?
It looked pretty lame.
It looked like lame old potato salad. You know,
that's right. Well, what it brought to mind for me was I remember back in the 70s, the guy who invented the pet rock, and he made like millions of dollars basically just selling people a rock. And after that, everybody tried to come up with the next pet rock. And so it's one of those things where a guy does something funny and gets away with it and walks away for nothing with 50 grand in his pocket. But it's all the imitators we're going to have to put up with now.
There is actually somebody in Seattle, this is a real thing, who has raised $20 so far to make macaroni salad.
Oh.
That is not a joke. That is really happening on the internet
and
right now.
That is what happened to the pet rock imitators, too.
I was a bit resentful of this guy during this week. I think it was mostly jealousy. But then I also thought about it. And I mean, if you look at it like an art project, right? I mean, what did Andy Warhol do? How is modifying a can of Campbell's soup that different than, you know, the internet art project of posting a picture of potato salad?
And there's a nice criticism in there of all the really stupid ideas that get funded on Kickstarter that, you know, are no smarter than making potato salad.
All right. Next story. Jay Inslee, governor of this state, you guys may have heard of him. He is working on something called the State Pollution Control Formula. And it turns out a big part of this has to do with the levels of toxic waste, essentially, that are allowed into our rivers and streams and lakes. It comes down to something called the fish consumption rate. The previously buried fish consumption rate, which currently is about 6.5 grams per day per person, can fit on a cracker, the Seattle Times says. Jay Inslee wants to up that to 175 grams a day, or almost 8 ounces, which is like a dinner-sized piece of fish. Because if we are assumed to be eating that much fish a day, it changes the amount of waste that can go into our water. Number one, how much fish have you guys eaten today in pounds?
Oh, starting I'm at with 0 pounds.
You're at 0 pounds.
At the moment, but the day is young.
Indeed.
I'm at zero, but I did have fish for dinner last night.
How much fish did you have? Could it fit on a cracker or would you?
It would be close to this 175 grams. It was one serving.
Is there any way that we're all eating that much fish every day, the amount of fish that is, I don't know what.
Well, some people eat way more than that. And that's one of the controversies of the whole thing is that a lot of the Native American tribes eat up to like 500 grams a day,
and
a much higher level. And of course, the fish consumption in Ballard used to be much higher.
This all connects to a very obscure mathematical equation or even an algorithm, I think they call it, that the state has. And so the fish consumption rate is just one variable in this algorithm. And if you up the consumption rate, then you have to drop down the amount of pollution you can put in the water. There's a fundamental flaw when I'm looking at it with this algorithm, which is that it assumes that if we weren't eating fish, then we could just pollute the water. Right. I mean, it comes from kind of a screwy perspective that we are only stopping ourselves from polluting Puget Sound and all the other waters in Washington State because it might come back and bite us when we ingest fish.
The new Inslee package, though, contains a legislative proposal that would give the Department of Ecology the ability to actually ban outright certain substances, which it doesn't have, like PCBs. I mean, it's a certain amount of PCBs can go in the water. Companies like Boeing don't like that because they want to be able to pollute more because of jobs.
But I mean, let's just take, I guess, the sort of the conservative argument for a moment. And if it does, in fact, cost these companies more money, which the cost, I guess, allegedly gets passed on to the rest of us in one way or another. And we're controlling this because there's a small group of people that are just lined up at the Skipper's all-you-can-eat buffet. I mean, if a small part of the population is consuming so much food fish that it's skewing it for the rest of us, I mean...
Well, but also, if you're in business, what you want is you want predictability. And so you see these new regulations coming along, and you say, okay, but what happens next? Because you need to know what kind of business you can run. You need to have a sense of it. Clearly, the amount of fish, this bit on the cracker, is too small to count for a place that has a lot of people who fish, a lot of Asian Pacific Islanders who eat a lot of fish, and also Native Americans.
Side note, they seem to be doing pretty well. Those, you know, older Japanese folks you see walking around with a spring in their step or eating, allegedly anyway, fish, you know, for two or three meals a day.
The question is fish with what kind of chemical?
Right. The business argument here is that we want them to be at a, I think, 10 times higher risk of getting cancer, or even more than that. And on the question of what happens if we up the rate to 175 grams, it's not a mystery. Business doesn't have to sit there and say, this is mysterious. We don't know what's going to happen. Oregon raised its rate to 175 grams, exactly what Inslee just said he wants to raise Washington's rate to, and Oregon has not fallen into catastrophic collapse.
Mm-hmm.
There is Portland, but...
Right, but that's not related necessarily
to the
water supply.
Right.
All right, we are in the final minute here of the thunder round, you guys. And as we started the show by mentioning, some human skulls were donated to the local Goodwill. What is your guys' favorite find you've ever picked up? And I hope it's not anatomical in that fashion. Like, do you guys get out to the Goodwill? Is that where you do your skull shopping?
It was three human skulls, and then I took it back, and it's caused some problems, I hear.
I thought it was interesting because I was listening to a piece on KUOW this week where they interviewed, it was Jamala Henderson was talking to, I guess, a person who's in charge of the repatriation, and she seemed to only think that the Native American skull should be repatriated. And I was like, these other poor people, they have, you know, it's just, I guess... throw it in the dumpster or something, because there was three skulls that were found. But anyway, that's just a word to everybody this weekend as you go through your day. Don't donate any human skulls to the Goodwill. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks, Skip Berger. Thanks, Eli Sanders, and also Joni Balter. Wear some sunscreen.